Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
This podcast is part of the BombPod Media Network.
Hey, this is Tony Merkel, host of The Confessionals, a BombPod Media Network podcast that brings you weekly interviews with eyewitness accounts of strange and unexplained events. From paranormal activity to UFO encounters to Bigfoot sightings, step into The Confessionals as we explore mysterious and real-life stories. Check us out on your favorite podcast app or theconfessionalspodcast.com. And many thanks to Hillbilly Horror Stories for having me on the show. I'll see you all on The Confessionals.
All right, guys, and welcome to episode 60 of Hillbilly Horror Stories. This is Jerry, and I'm joined by my lovely wife, Tracy.
Hey, guys, how are you?
Well, we've got a surprise for you. We're actually on vacation this week, and we're actually, as we speak, we're at Scarefest. And, well, not as we speak, because actually this is in advance, but when you're hearing this, we're actually going to be just getting back from Scarefest, and we didn't really have an opportunity to do a full show like we normally would. So I went to our fantastic Patreon listeners, and I said, hey, we're going to be out of town, and we're got Scarefest, but we don't want to not have a show out that week. We've went almost roughly 60 weeks, obviously, without missing a show, and we don't want to miss this week. And as you know, our Patreon subscribers, who actually pay anywhere from $1 to $10 a month, they get bonus episodes. And I asked those guys, I said, look, I know you pay for this, but would you guys be okay if we took one of these bonus episodes that is done just like a regular show and put it up that week that we're out? That way, it fixes two problems. First of all, you guys get a show instead of us, and we get a break. So, not that we need a break, but we do need a break. So, but it gives us a much-needed week off, but at the same time, we don't miss a show. So, you're going to get to hear what the Patreon listeners get to listen to. And it's also going to be good for you guys to see that, because a lot of shows, when they do Patreon, they'll release a couple of bonus episodes to everybody so you can see what you're going to get. And we didn't do that. So you guys, if you're not a Patreon, you really don't even know what these bonus shows are like. So this is going to give you a taste of what the bonus show is. What we're going to be talking about tonight, it's a two-parter. It's going to be on the Son of Sam. And most people will tell you this may be our best show that we did on Patreon, and it's one of the best shows that we've ever done. So I think you're going to enjoy it. But we do Son of Sam, and then we go into The Beast of Bray Road. So you get a little bit of paranormal, a little bit of true crime. These episodes are always an hour or so. But I also wanted to make sure that our Patreon listeners didn't get shafted this week, and the only episode's up is one they've already heard. So what we're going to do is, we have, at the very beginning of the show, I did a really cool interview with Ryan from Rumor Flies. They're actually part of the Dark Myths Collective, the group that we're in. And he came on and did about 40 minutes of talking about haunted bars in New Orleans, because that's where they're from. And he did 40 minutes talking about haunted bars, and he's got a cool-ass story that ties in with the axe murder deals that we did with the Axeman. Because they were right in that area where the Axeman of New Orleans, and there is actually a woman that at one point in time with a cult that they are trying to pin a lot of these on, and it's a fascinating story, and he's going to come on and tell you about that. So that's how we're going to start off. We're going to do 40 minutes with them. I think you're really going to enjoy him. He's a great storyteller. And then we're going to go into the bonus episode. And so when it's all said and done, you're going to end up with about a two-hour show tonight. So not too bad for us having a week off.
Yeah, we appreciate you guys understanding and being patient. And it's not that we need a vacation from this part of our lives. It's we need a vacation from the working part of our lives.
Yeah, we like this part.
Oh, yeah.
But when you combine the two together, it's daunting. I mean, when you think about it, I mean, I'm not looking for any kind of sympathy, but the reality of it is we started this right before I had my heart surgery. And over the last year, I took 4 weeks off for heart surgery that was supposed to be 6 to 8 weeks and jumped right into working 6 days a week, 70 hours a week, plus 20 hours a week on the podcast, not including the extra episodes we do, for basically over a little over a year now. And I am worn out. I'm not going to lie. So it'd be nice to actually get all this done in advance and have some fun. But we appreciate all you guys, and we love you. And that's why we didn't want to have a week where you didn't have an episode. We know some of you really depend on these to get you through your horrible Mondays. So we appreciate it, and this is what we did for you. And like I said, we went the extra mile to get some extra bonus episode in there for the people who have already heard this one. So we love you guys and enjoy, and we will see you next week. I'm joined on the phone now with Ryan from Rumor Flies. And Ryan, you guys are part of our the Dark Myth Collective, so you're a brother, so to speak.
And yes, we are.
You got a really cool show, and I first found out about your show when you did a crossover episode with the Mad Scientist podcast, which we've had Chris on our show before. And I thought it was a fascinating, and that's really the show that got me listening to your backlog. So tell me a little bit about your show. What draws the listeners in? What do you guys, what is the main premise of your show every week, and who's a part of it?
So I think one of our guys, Greg, has a better tagline than me for it, and I think I'm going to steal it from him. He says that Rumor Flies looks into the myths, misconceptions, and general urban legends throughout everyday culture. And we try to get to the bottom of it through anything from just book smarts to easy Google searches. Nothing that is like heavy testing or research, not like Mythbusters, to say, where you just they go out and test stuff in a lab, which I love. We have one, but we don't. But in general, we just try to get to the original source of all these like myths and misconceptions. Anywhere between history to food to mass media to sports, just about anything you could think of. The only thing we don't really touch is religion or politics, but everything else is pretty much on the table. And we do everything we can to find the original source of where this rumor started, or even if it's true. Usually it's hard to get both at the same time, but sometimes we do. And occasionally we try to keep it a little bit lighthearted if possible.
Yeah, you guys do a good job of interacting with each other, so it is a really lighthearted show. It's really fun. Give a couple of examples of some show topics you guys have had over the course of your podcast.
Oh, boy. Some stuff that's as simple as, you know, was there cocaine in Coca-Cola? That one's always a pretty big favorite. The whole thing of was Walt Disney Frozen? One of my favorite ones, it happens to be a history one, even though I'm not a history major. Paul Revere, the guy that did the ride, and, you know, the British are coming. Simple one for that one. Number one, there were several people. Number two, he got caught halfway and didn't make it. Other people did. He got turned away and they just took his horse and he had to walk back. Number three, everybody was British back then. So that was not exactly a good thing to say. They actually said the regulars are coming. So it's stuff like that you don't even think of, really. Like the British are coming type of deal that I love. It's one of those where there's that little bit of logic where once it hits you, you're just like, wow, okay, now that doesn't make any sense at all. So it's that type of stuff. Another off-the-top example is when we just like looked up the whole myth about, you know, the head can survive when it's decapitated for some odd amount of seconds after death, after, you know, it's chopped off. I know that's one of the gorier ones, but it's hillbilly horror stories. I figure I can talk about it. Yeah. It's true. From all accounts that they've seen, they haven't done it recently because there's something called ethics and science now. But now, but apparently back then they did tests and they had a few volunteer executions. Well, I guess executionees, I guess is what you call them. Just say, all right, you're going to blink a few times after you get your head chopped off and we're going to keep trying to wake you up as it's going. And it turns out that there was some, it seems like, conscious response. So stuff like that is fascinating to me. And then there's just stuff like, you know, how to sear the perfect steak. You know, it's just...
But those two go hand in hand.
We cover everything. Yeah. Oh, yeah. What's better than execution than a barbecue afterwards?
That's right. Either way it goes, it's getting fried up. So...
Gotta get the cheek has the most fat in it, you know? Oh, okay, I'll stop with cannibalism.
So let me ask you this. What made you guys start the show, and who else is on the show? I know Greg's on the show. Is it just you two, or occasionally there's somebody else, correct?
So the two main hosts is... Josh and myself, and Greg likes to consider himself we consider him it too, a producer and fact checker. He doesn't like to take the mic as much for this show because generally Josh and I have known each other since, Jesus, sixth grade, I think now. But to start with, Greg had a podcast previously called Projecting, and it was kind of just an interview podcast where he talked to anybody. And I had known Greg from high school. Then we caught back up after not talking for some odd amount of years. Just, you know, we went to different colleges and everything. Went on there, talked a little bit about when I used to work in a lab. I went on his show to pretty much clear up some stuff about, A, the whole searing steak thing. You're not supposed to do it. And then I talked to clear up some, you know, misconceptions about GMOs because it's one of the things I'm also very passionate about. Afterwards, he was like, that was really great. You ever thought about starting a podcast? And it's like, actually I have. And it was kind of me pitching the idea of Rumor Flies to him. He thought it was really cool. And at the same time, I had talked to Josh, who I, you know, hang out with regularly. And he's the one I have the best rapport with when it comes to just back and forth. And, you know, he's a smart guy too. So we decided to, you know, all three start up and get this thing going. And it's just history from there.
And my apologies to Josh, because that's what I actually meant to say when I said Greg, because I know Greg is a little more in the background, but for some reason, I guess because I talked to Greg earlier, he was in the forefront of my mind.
Yeah, we have to prod him with the stick when he's on air.
Yeah. So the one of the reasons that you're on the show tonight is you had said that, you know, you kind of like the paranormal, the kind of spooky, the kind of eerie, creepy kind of stories, true crime, that and such, that you guys don't deal with a whole lot on your show. And And I said, hey, it'd be cool if you wanted to come on and talk about some of that stuff on this show. So I think you actually worked up some stories to talk about.
Yes, I did. One of them is longer than the rest of them. The main one that I want to talk about is somebody named Clementine Barnabé, as they would say in Cajun country. But essentially, I want to talk a little bit about her, who is a very undercovered or miscovered, or I don't know. I haven't seen a whole lot about her on many other podcasts or many mass media. There's only a few articles about him, and it's kind of I had to kind of throw them all together to get some of the facts straight. And then also, you had mentioned that you were kind of interested in some of the haunted New Orleans bars, and Rumor Flies is based out of New Orleans, and some of these bars that I can actually talk about are actually my favorites that are in the area.
Awesome.
So which one do you want first, the bars or Clementine?
Let's go ahead and do, which one is the longer story, did you say?
Clementine is the longer one.
Let's go ahead and knock the bars out, and we'll finish up with Clementine.
Sure. All right. So the bars is pretty short. There's actually a lot of supposedly haunted bars in New Orleans. However, I think a lot of them are actually, not to demystify anybody on the show, I think a lot of them are really just for tourist attractions. You know, they'll say anything is haunted just to get a few people in, and New Orleans has a very rich history. It's one of the oldest cities in the southern United States. It's older than the United States itself, and some of the bars I'm about to mention are as well. And, of course, there's going to come some lore. You know, we had the Great Fire of New Orleans. You guys have covered several paranormal things in New Orleans, such as the Axeman of New Orleans, supposedly, if that's paranormal. Or you also covered Delphine Lalaurie, who I actually very much liked that episode. It was a good explanation. But there's tons of history. New Orleans was built up upon itself several times. As you may have known, the House of the Rising Sun, there's like six different locations that they think might be the House of the Rising Sun, and they dig up a new one like every 5 years or so. It's really a mysterious city for the most part. I love it and hate it at the same time, but mostly love. Anyway, so we'll get started with the first one that is probably the most famous. You mentioned Lafitte's Blacksmith Shop particularly to me, and this one is actually my favorite bar in the city. It is originally built in 1772 and is regarded as being the oldest building used as a bar. And I say building used as a bar because there's some place in Rhode Island that is supposedly the longest running bar in the United States. Now, it's called Lafitte's Blacksmith Shop because it supposedly, during the time of the Battle of New Orleans and during the Spanish occupation, during the French occupation, Jean Lafitte apparently went there a whole lot to make plans for whatever plunder he was doing or whatever battle plans he was planning or whatever treasures he was planning to bury. Apparently, he frequented that place constantly. And this building actually does look starkly different from everything else around it. It's one of the only buildings still left in the French Quarter that has like the original French architecture from that time that has been minimally rebuilt from. It actually did catch on fire one or two times, I believe. But it survived and it's still there. It's awesome inside. When you walk in, there's only candle lighting in there. They have great drinks. It's always pretty crowded, but it's because it's so famous. There's a piano in the back where there's always a piano player that'll just do any requests you want. The atmosphere is amazing. Now, that being said, it also is a place to get trashed if you really want to, because, you know, the drinks are actually pretty cheap compared to most of the French Quarter. Now, for the hauntings, some of the lore around it is that there's a fireplace in the middle of the bar, right by the actual bar where you get your drinks at. And in this fireplace, they believe that Jean Lafitte actually had buried some of his treasure. And that sounds like kind of a strange place to do that, because it's kind of the most hidden in plain sight type of places, and it doesn't seem like you'd need a lot to, you know, dig it up. But I like the myth. I very, in a different state of mind, nearly climbed into that fireplace one time, but that's for another day. Now, after that, they also believe that Jean Lafitte himself has haunted Lafitte's Blacksmith Shop ever since he died. And everybody says the whole normal issue of they see a man in the back darkened corner of Lafitte's, which you have to believe that because it is extremely dark back there, especially if some of the candles goes out. They believe they see a man in anachronist clothing than right now, where it looks like he's from the Revolutionary War times, and he's like twirling his mustache and has his black gloves. At the same time, you see much crazier shit in Bourbon Street, so it could be just a regular person. I've seen many Jean Lafitte impersonators down there too. Also, I'm just going to say, I know I'm covering the haunted bars, but I think the last person I want to trust about a haunting that is freshly drunk while telling the story, you know?
True. So,
I mean, who knows? It might be Jean Lafitte. But this guy actually, he does the rounds, because the next place I want to talk to is another place that's very confused. Also, to continue, before I get off of Lafitte's Blacksmith Shop, apparently Marie Laveau and Delphine Lalaurie herself have been seen at or around Lafitte's Blacksmith Shop.
Well, of
so
course.
There's a famous cast of characters hanging around that bar.
Well, I mean, why wouldn't they be? I mean, that's, you know.
Yeah.
It's like it's like the pictures you always see of like James Dean and Marilyn Monroe and Elvis all in the same picture. That would actually
be right next door they have the 27 Club with Kurt Cobain and, you know, what's her name, Janis Joplin hanging out with Jimi Hendrix too. They have an old timey New Orleans We Died Near These Bars club too.
Wow. That's...
So continuing on, and also that's a strange cast character if you think. You have a guy that's a pirate or privateer depending on who you're speaking to, a voodoo queen, and then the exact opposite of Voodoo Queen. Delphine Lalaurie is a miserably bad person, or at least was. Maybe she still is in the afterlife now, but I don't see them having much in common. But no. Continuing on, we're going to go to another place called Lafitte's in Exile. Now, a lot of people confuse this place with Lafitte's blacksmith shop, but they are in the same area, and they both hold a certain title. Lafitte's blacksmith shop is one of the oldest buildings in the United States to be used as a bar, and Lafitte's in Exile is the oldest gay bar in the country. So they both have their own claim to fame. Now, supposedly Lafitte's in Exile was frequented by Tennessee Williams himself, the person who wrote Streetcar Named Desire, you know, Stanley and, what's her name? Stella. Yeah, Stella. Yeah. And I'm Stella. Trying to think of the mistress's name. Blanche DuBois. So Tennessee Williams, the writer of the play Streetcar Named Desire, he is well known in this area. And also, he apparently has frequented this bar and is now still frequenting it in the afterlife. But guess who else is?
Who?
Jean Lafitte and Marie Laveau.
Of course they are. Of course yes. They are. Well, they're probably coming yes. for the drag shows.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Most certainly. I mean, who wouldn't? They're fun. But anyway, apparently they really like frequenting that place as well. And apparently alcoholism exists in the afterlife. So they are, once again, doing their rounds. So going on from the Lafitte's in Exile, not much has been said about any history or gruesome history behind it. Lafitte's blacksmith shop, they said they had the fire, and then the association was Jean Lafitte. But it gets a little bit bloodier as it goes down here with the list. Continuing on, though, Lafitte's didn't really have any events that I saw that would have led to any sort of paranormal occurrences. And I parsed this list from a giant bunch of bars, but a bunch of them were just that stuff like, oh, we believe we heard things behind us, or some of the employees saw something moving at night. But these are the ones that I would give a little bit of, I guess, what credence I can to.
I would think being the oldest gay bar, they probably see a lot of Lafitte's behind Lee ears.
Yes, exactly. Jesus. So moving on, the old Absinthe House. Now, it actually is a pretty damn old Absinthe House because it existed before Absinthe was actually outlawed in the United States. As most people know now, Absinthe is a, which also we covered on Rumor Flies, it is not a hallucinogenic, it's not a hallucinogenic type of alcohol, as some people say it is. It's just not. It was kind of a smear campaign against it, and most likely people were getting lead poisoning, or they were getting methanol poisoning from it, which is a completely different type of deal from a trip. So, New Orleans is known for its absinthe. A lot of our cocktails, like the Sazerac, which originated here, or the Old Fashioned, which also originated here, did something. They had an absinthe wash where you just kind of like put a little bit of absinthe in the glass and then rinse it around and dump it out, and then you pour the rest of your glass, so you have like the aroma of it around the rim. Now it is back in business. It has lots of different absinthes. All of them are very good, depending on if you're into like the licorice flavor or the bitter flavor or not. But this place is one of the older bars in the city, too, and there was, once again, a fire near this place, and there have been a few deaths. Not exactly there. They believe that there was kind of a bootlegging run. There's old lore that is not really backed up, that there is a tunnel between the old Absinthe House and Lafitte's blacksmith shop. That's interesting, but at the same time, we can't dig more than 4 feet down without making a puddle because we are just so below sea level here. So there's not a lot of credence to that. But there could have been some bootlegger or mafia activity around the old Absinthe House at the time, which would lead to this place to possibly be haunted by Jean Lafitte and Marie Laveau.
Well, of course.
Do you see the underlying theme that's going on here? I am not bullshitting you on this. I looked at a bunch of different places, and even the websites themselves have said, we've seen these people. And really, you know, Tennessee Williams, you can take, what's his name? Vincent Marcello, one of the big mob bosses. They just got to parse out these famous New Orleans figures, but you can't all take Jean Lafitte and Marie Laveau. And nobody wants Delphine Lalaurie because she's just creepy and, you know, just she was a general bitch. I'm sorry. That's just what she was. But nobody wants her. So I'm done with the Lafitte and Laveau haunts, though. I got two more that I particularly want to talk about. One of them is called Pat O'Brien's. Have you heard of Pat O'Brien's at all, Jerry?
No, he's the sportscaster, right?
That is a Pat O'Brien. I don't know if this is the same Pat O'Brien, though, because this place, I think, has been around much longer. This place is the originator of a drink. I'm not sure how well-known it is countrywide, but it's called the Hurricane. And yep. It's just generally a rum-based drink with fruit juices and a major hangover to follow. It's delicious, but you pay for it. So this place actually has quite a few hauntings. And one of them is supposedly a ladies' bathroom, which I didn't know about until today. I've been to this place tons of times, and I haven't heard anything about this. But apparently the ladies' bathroom on the second floor of Pat O'Brien's is supposedly inhabited by a very, very vigilant servant that decided to not take off of her shift after she died. Supposedly there's been a servant woman that would, I guess, be one of the bathroom attendants, I guess you'd call them, that would be in an ethereal form as ladies went in and out of the bathroom or went to go wash their hands and such. Now, this is the worst type of haunting for me, because if you go to some places in New Orleans, there are bars where they just have some guy that just hangs out by the door and dispenses soap or grabs a paper towel for you and expects you to tip him afterwards. Yep. I'm not a stingy person. Just, I want to tip you for something that I generally will not be able to do easily by myself. Now, having a ghost do that and they will just follow you and haunt you if you don't tip them, that's a problem. Supposedly, this lady is benevolent, though, and has not really caused any harm to anybody. Now, continuing on, the piano bar, which is, I guess I want to say towards the back of this place, it's a big, like, L-shaped courtyard, and there's several inner places with a restaurant and the bar area. The piano bar supposedly has your normal, like, almost, not poltergeist activity, but just your physical hauntings, where glasses are moved across the table, things shatter, chairs are just thrown across, like, late at night as people are closing up. And that one is the cool one, because I think it actually is like a video floating around the internet somewhere of that happening at Pat O'Brien's. I think that was the right place. But there's several locations at Pat O'Brien's, so I'm not sure if it was this particular one. But they're actually, I think one of the ghost shows went there recently. And but anyway, and to top that off, apparently there is a recent haunt there. Supposedly, Pat O'Brien's is also haunted by Ray Walston of My Favorite Martian. I'm not shitting you. That's what they say on the they can say anything on the internet, but that's on like a few different haunted ghost tour websites, that apparently a man that looks very much like Ray Walston is haunting Pat O'Brien's and just kind of scaring the crap out of people there. I don't know how threatening Ray Walston would look, but this guy died in 2001. I don't get why he picked Pat O'Brien's afterwards. I don't know. I guess he had some sort of, he was from New Orleans, but he had some sort of connection to here. If you have any idea of why a celebrity such as him would be there, please let me know.
That makes no sense to me.
Yeah. So lastly, the other place that I want to talk about that I've been to several times and is just an awesome, awesome place to go. If you guys ever come down here, I would love to show it to you. It's open to anybody. There's a restaurant right by the St. Louis Cathedral in the heart of the French Quarter called Muriel's, and they have a certain place called the Seance Room. And when you walk in there, there's no Ouija boards or anything like that. There's no seance table. It's just this awesome, dimly lit, like, red lounge that just looks opulent and looks like it hasn't been touched by the modern age since the times of, I would say, like, the 20s or 30s. There's even, like, a full-size sarcophagus in there. It's just plain awesome. I wish I could send you pictures of it. But anybody that Googles the Seance Room at Muriel's, you'll be in for a treat. Because you can actually get a drink and then just go enjoy it there. And for some reason, it's not usually ever that crowded. So that place is awesome, but it apparently has a very famous haunt. Because in the stairwell of Muriel's, if you go up to the second floor to eat, there's a sign, there's a table right under the stairs. Because they're not exactly a spiral, but they're angled. And right in that little nook, there's a table for a certain gambler that was there at the time, in the 30s, who was down on his luck, lost everything, and just decided it was over. And he killed himself at Muriel's. And supposedly he still haunts the place, and every now and then the waitstaff will actually bring, if not a full meal, then at least a glass of wine to that table and leave it there as kind of, I guess, you know, pouring one out for their dead gambler homie. But that's a pretty cool tradition. for Muriel's. Like, I love it. It adds, even if it's not true at all, the guy actually has a name. It's just very hard to pronounce. But if it is even true at all, or if it isn't, it's still a really cool story, and it kind of made me want to go back just because of seeing, like, the ritual to it. I thought it was really cool. That's kind of like a little tasting of some of the haunted bars that you can go to. Lafitte's is still my number one to go to, but Muriel's Seance Room is also wonderful, but you're going to need like a probably at least a college shirt to go in there.
Okay. Well, we're gonna be down there in August for the Potter and Love Festival, obviously, so we'll have to make sure you guys show us around a little bit.
Oh, I don't know if you're a man of vices, but I will drag you around the quarter if you want me to. So, well, but anyway, so can we get to the bloodiness of Clementine Bonabe?
Yes, because I'm very interested in this story. You've piqued my curiosity.
Yes, so I think I kind of had an extra hook to it that I guess made you let me do this, I guess. But this story is just another one of your general, it seems like true crime at first, but then it has another layer of it that makes it almost True Detective, which is an awesome show. So, anyway, it starts in a place called Crowley, Louisiana, in January of 1911, when a family was found dead in their house with wounds so grievous that their skulls were split open. Not only was it hit with the front end of the axe, but the assailant had also taken the blunt end of the axe and hit the back of their head and crushed them, too. And the killer supposedly, after police investigation, they say he or she entered through a window, killed the family all at once, then left the axe at the head of the bed in a bucket full of the victim's blood in the corner of the room. Creepy enough as it is. And also, I just listened to your recent episode that you had about the axe murders, or your grand unifying axe murder theory. You mentioned a few of these axe murders very briefly in passing towards the end of the episode. And we're actually going to give a little bit of more exposition to them.
Cool.
Now, after that January 1911 incident, there was another incident in, depending on which source you're looking at, January or February of 1911, also in Crowley, Louisiana. The Byers family, consisting of a husband, wife, and son, were found hacked to death. And the police described them to have been so mutilated that they were, quote, brained with an axe, which is just a weird, weird term that I'm not sure if I'm glad it is no longer in circulation, or I really wish that there was a C-list horror movie called Brained with an Axe. But that's the way it was described. And I assume if they say brained with an axe, that means there were probably some brains spilling out afterwards. So these are gruesome murders, and nobody was spared. You know, husband, wife, and son. And somebody apparently was very good with an axe, too, because the same thing happened. Axe was left by the bed. Now, February 25th in Lafayette, Louisiana, which is about 24 miles from Crowley. Some people say Crowley, I think it's British, but I'm from Louisiana, and we say everything wrong, so I'm going to say Crowley, and that's how they say it, so doing it. The Andrus family, who also consisted of a husband, wife, and two children, one of them 3 years old, I believe, and the other one was 11 months old. They were murdered, and the bodies were arranged on the bed together, and the parents and the kids. And it was almost like this intentional, like ritualistic type of thing. It seems like the killer is getting a hang of this, or is getting more comfortable with, you know, adding a little bit more to the scene. Because Mimi Andrus was propped up over her husband Alexander's body as if in prayer, and the children were laid out neatly at the front of the bed at the feet of the parents. So it's getting a little bit worse. And, you know, I would say that this is 24 miles isn't long. Even in 1911, there's trains that go that way and back and forth. Something that I really tried to do for this investigation, or looking at these investigations, was really try to get the distances figured out, because you really got to take that into consideration for a case that seems to be so muddled in either rumors or just bad reporting or just hearsay. And it's just a lot of people want to tie things together. But really, locations is important, just to see how feasible it would be for somebody to be able to do this. Now, the investigations led at first to a man called Raymond Barnabé. And he was a known petty felon in the area and was a general jackass from everything I read. Now, after a fight between Raymond and his mistress, remember I said General Jackass, his mistress suggested to a friend that Raymond may have been involved with the murders. So this may have just been like her being spiteful and not really realizing that what she says has consequences. Because something that I haven't mentioned yet, but I think will actually play into it later on and now, is just about everybody in this story is black. Everything from the murderers and all the victims. All of them were from poor black areas of town. So that also is a reason why the investigation may have been kind of poor at the time. But it does have some interesting like left and right turns. So now that I was saying that, Raymond was, the police were generally looking for any reason to find somebody to arrest. And like I said, she may have not thought of the consequences of just being in that situation and then saying that this man who is known to be a thief and also is probably in one of the lower runs of society at the time may have been the person that murdered everybody. That's an easy way for the police to pick up somebody, get them to confess one way or another, and then just be done with it. And even if the murders were solved or not, the public is not worried about it anymore because they have their supposed man. You get the following of that, I guess, the reasoning for it. So that's kind of what led to Clementine Barnabé to enter the scene. Now, whether it was true or not, what the mistress said, Clementine Barnabé and her brother Zephyrin did not help. Now, Raymond's October 1911 trial resulted in his children, Zephyrin and Clementine, testifying against him on the stand, saying that he had come home bloody on occasion and bragged about killing the Andrus family from earlier, along with also threatening the children's lives himself. So Raymond was actually imprisoned after this. So it gets a little bit confusing from here. You would think they have their man, because they're pretty much arresting somebody that whether he was guilty or not, nobody's going to miss him being gone. So continuing on, in November 1911, after Raymond was imprisoned, another family was killed in the same horrific manner. The Randall family from Lafayette, like I said, only 24 miles from Crowley, consisted of a husband, wife, and three children, once again, and were found, the wife and the children were murdered with an axe. The children were dismembered this time, and the husband was actually shot in the head. So this is the only time that this entire series of murders that a gun will come into play, but everything else was still very much along the same MO of the husband, of, you know, the axe murders. So it's starting to seem like Raymond may have not been the one that did it, considering he was in prison when this happened, or at least jail. So nearly immediately afterwards, Sheriff Louis Lacoste arrested both Clementine and Zephyrin Barnabé on suspicion of a character profile from the trial. Since they got to talk about their dad, their neighbors also had talked about them, because even though Raymond was a suspect, everyone around him was too, essentially. And some of the neighbors of Clementine said that they had called Clementine Zephyrin filthy, shifty, and degenerate. You know, the trifecta. So, on top of that, blood was also found on Clementine's clothes when they had investigated Raymond for the Andrus murders. And not only that, people supposedly had seen Clementine sneaking around some of the those parts of town after those murders, like very shiftily in the dark. Whether that's hearsay or not, we don't know. It's just what was said in court. Now, additionally after that, when Clementine was arrested, the investigators found a dress belonging to one of the murder victims, spattered with blood and brain matter. Now, Zephyrin got off with an alibi, but Clementine, they had the smoking gun on her, and she was taken to jail. So, needless to say, whether all of these were her, it seems like at least one was. Would you agree with that, Jerry? I mean,
that's what it sounds like.
It's starting to seem like there might be a little bit of teamwork going on.
Yeah, I mean, I can definitely see how that connection could be made.
Yes. Now, here's where it start getting a little bit crazy. Shortly after Clementine was taken to jail, in January 1912, in Lake Charles, Louisiana, which is 50 miles from Crowley, the Broussard family was found ritualistically murdered with an axe. Once again, poor black part of town, and it was a relatively sizable family. So all five of the family were killed with an axe, and their blood was collected in a bucket again. So this is coming back. But here's the crazy part about it. So all of the children in the house, their fingers were splayed with little rolled pieces of paper. So say like you have like a candy wrapper or something, just roll it up into like a tube, mm-hmm. and their fingers were either splayed with that or like little pieces of wood or toothpicks. They were splayed in between each other to the point where they're making like a very wide five with their hands. All of them. Every hand. And then afterwards, there was a signature on the door that said the human five. And depending on which source you're looking at, it said it was either written in pencil or blood. Now, I don't know how those two are confused, but once again, this story has a lot of different sources and none of them can seem to agree on everything. So the human five was listed under there, but over the human five signature was a Bible passage, once again, written in blood or pencil, depending on who you talk to, from Psalm 9. And it said, "When he maketh inquisition for blood, he forgetteth not the cry of the humble." So that is straight up creepy afterwards. You know, it's one thing to murder people, but then to leave cryptic messages afterwards, that's when I would go into full panic mode if I was a sheriff. It's just not something I would ever want on my hands. So, the other murders, in, there were other murders in Texas in a similar fashion shortly after this, and a lot of people like to attribute this to Clementine or around the time they like to do that. But eventually, they were traced to a different man named Jim Fields. So she's off the hook for those. But the reason why people thought that was because there was a train line going between, what's it called, Crowley, Lafayette, and certain parts of Texas like San Antonio and Austin, which if just it's a straight line back to Cajun country. So somebody could get away or get to those areas in a relatively short amount of time. Now, this is when the police start cracking down on Clementine. And this is when she confessed to up to 17 murders as an accomplice with not only her father, but three others in the supposed Human Five, this group that she was talking about. And she said in her first account that they were trying out a voodoo ritual after acquiring a voodoo charm from a very powerful witch doctor. And she, along with the 17 murders, because the ones that I said didn't quite add up to 17, she also confessed to some murders that happened in 1909 that consequently were done with an axe as well and were also in the near area to Crowley. Now, this witch doctor, after police interview, claimed to be nothing more than a herbologist. whether that's true or not, who knows? But it still keeps getting a little bit crazier because the names of the three accomplices that Clementine had included, even though she included her dad with her, so that's one like little credibility right there, the other three names led nowhere. So either she gave them fake names or these people are really good at hiding. So other accounts of her confession, and actually this is what she said on the stand in a, this is a much nicer way that I'm putting it. The way she said it on the stand and the way the reporter said she said it on the stand, not the best. So what she said in general was that the confessions have her linked to a supposed Church of Sacrifice, which was a cult led by a Reverend King Harris. This sounds extremely like True Detective to me, by the way. Season one, it's great. Also, I'm in it. Look for me in it one day. Just a cameo. She said that his congregation regularly had these electrifying sermons that had built up a bloodlust among them, and the murders themselves were a result of certain congregants not following God's word, and their punishment was to be carried out by the Human Five. That being Clementine Barnabé, her father Raymond, and then the three other unknown people. And she would change the story once again, however, to exclude her father because she heard that he was going to get executed if he was guilty. So that's where things get so, so crazy and cryptic, and I almost want it to be real if it wasn't for the fact that, you know, 17-plus people died. Now, her story has a few holes in it because Reverend Harris was a real person, but he adamantly claimed that neither he nor his associated sanctified church was involved with or had even heard of this supposed Church of Sacrifice. Now, that sounds pretty convenient for somebody that's possibly in a Church of Sacrifice.
True.
But we'll give him the pass for right now, considering that, you know... there was no evidence linking him directly aside from what Clementine said. There was no, you know, smoking gun, like, video in the basement type of deal. But Clementine retold her story several times in jail, and her death count, according to her, eventually got up to 35. So she was involved in at least 35 different murders. Now, if you are a little bit up on your true crime, That beats number one, who is John Gacy, John Wayne Gacy, with, I think, 33 is his number. It's either 33 or 37. Either way, that is like running with the best of the best right there, or the worst of the worst, rather.
She was trying to get some street cred.
What's that?
She was trying to get some street cred.
Yeah, exactly. You know, even before she's doing this before serial killer was even a term. That didn't come around until like the 50s or 60s. Now, supposedly Clementine was a model prisoner in jail and underwent a quote-unquote procedure that allowed her to be released on good behavior after only 10 years. Now, she was put in, this is amazing in the first place, because remember what I said about the whole judicial system? She was from a poor black part of town and a predominantly white police force, and it was a time when sunset cities were still around. You know, there were times where people weren't even allowed to be around at nightfall. There were people that were in very big danger, especially if they were linked to a crime. I was so surprised. Maybe it was that she was younger and that she was a female that she may have been let off a bit easier. But she was only sentenced to life under the insanity case that she was under perversion. It wasn't even for the murders. It was just perversion. So she was put in jail, went through this procedure, and supposedly was released after 10 years. So life in jail to 10 years. That's amazing. I don't think anybody gets that right now unless they're exonerated on DNA. Right. I don't know what she did, how model of a prisoner she was, unless she started being like, unless she started, I don't know, chaperoning all the other prisoners. And this is in Angola, too, which is famously a prison you do not want to go to in Louisiana. Still around. But it's that part is the craziest part to me. And even now, there is supposed saying that in the 40s, there was a woman that was told about Clementine Barnabé by her 100-something-year-old grandmother, and that's how the story kind of got some traction again. But when this woman's grandmother died, she was going through a box of her stuff and found an old picture of her grandmother, and the picture matched the exact image of Clementine Barnabé from the newspapers. So I think that's an awesome bit of lore. It's not exactly substantiated, but I'm choosing to believe that version since the trail kind of goes nowhere after Clementine is released. She may have just died peacefully, just doing her own thing. She may have gone to get a higher death count. Who knows? But I like that story the most, I think.
It's definitely now, it definitely kind of shoots holes in my theory.
Yeah. that theory, you have a pretty grim one. You just got some more time to just, you know, hammer it together. Because you got a world traveler right there. Villisca, Hinterkaifeck, and then Louisiana. That's some traveling. But it's still a fun one. I really enjoyed the episode, by the way.
Well, it did fit the time frame, though. If you follow the time frame, there was time to actually do all of that.
When you mentioned the axe being left at the head of the bed, I was like, yeah, the axe man did do that. And people actually have like linked this human 5 thing to the axe man as well. Since I think the X-Men only happens about 6 years after these murders ended. So maybe he, you know, shuffled down to New Orleans and decided to just, you know, start going axe happy unless he got some jazz. So if you want to talk a little bit of the evidence for and against Clementine, since that wraps up the story, there is no record of a Church of Sacrifice after this or somebody that tried to revive it. But who's to say? Because there were tons of old religions back in the day that just die off when their congregation dies off, or anything else. Some people are really good at keeping secrets, and maybe she was just really bad at keeping secrets, the one person in the congregation. But the evidence for it is that, like I said earlier, there's train lines between Lafayette, Crowley, Lake Charles, and Texas. And this is like something that she could reasonably do, is get in a train, go somewhere, do the murders, get right back on a train and go back, and then nobody would be any the wiser. And then also, there was the clothes. She did have the dress of, I believe, Mimi Andrus in her room with brain matter on it. Like, there's no disputing that. It was that. So that says she at least killed somebody, I would confidently say, or was in the room when somebody was killed, or helped to do the cleanup, if you want to call it that. Maybe she was like the bucket holder. I don't know. But that's about as far as it goes for her actual evidence. Now, there's something that you could put into a evidence for or against category. Now, she mentioned the human 5 in the Church of Sacrifice, right?
Mm-hmm.
She would have had to have seen the crime scene to have known about that. Or, this could be evidence against, We don't know how the, I guess, interrogation process went for them. She could have easily heard about the murders while she was in jail, just, you know, a little hearsay, and then heard about some of the details of it, and chose it and ran with it. And that's what just how this whole thing started snowballing. So that is one possibility. Now, I can't say one way or another, but I feel like also there was a chance that the police before, you know, interrogation techniques aren't to their standard today. The police were just like, are you sure you didn't write anything strange on a wall? Like, does this Bible passage mean anything to you? And then says it. And then that's when she starts to kind of just make this story out of these few leading threads, which is sometimes what a lot of people do for attention. There are tons of false confessions every year because people want attention. And just they might want to, you know, get their rep. You know, I'm already going to prison. I may as well admit to more things just so I, you know, look like a badass going down. The particular person I'm thinking of is Henry Lee Lucas, supposedly killed hundreds of people. The Florida Drifter, he really was only, you know, convicted for maybe three or four, but his story is supposedly hundreds. So some people just go for it for the attention. This may have been the situation with her. Also, the evidence against it that could have built this whole Church of Sacrifice thing is the fact that papers tend to sensationalize. Coming from this part of town, voodoo was a real thing, and it is still a very well-practiced religion, and it was a practiced religion back then. However, a lot of people, especially the white community of this area, and, you know, and consequently most of Louisiana, where voodoo was mostly practiced, saw this as a bastardization of Roman Catholicism, because there is elements of Roman Catholicism and Haitian voodoo just thrown into this Creole voodoo that exists in this area. And it could have just been this big scare thing because, I mean, yes, snakes are involved. Yes, there are some strange rituals with either, you know, chickens or just things that aren't normal for what most people would see. It doesn't mean it's evil, though, but it's easy to make it look like it's evil. I think that even right now, a lot of people see voodoo as a dark thing when generally voodoo is not supposed to be a violent religion. Have you guys covered voodoo yet at all in any of your episodes?
Yeah, we actually covered when we did Marie Laveau and Marie Brown, and we actually had a young lady come on and actually talk about the differences between hoodoo, voodoo, and then the New Orleans style as opposed to the Haitian style voodoo.
Right. Oh, yeah, Marie Brown was great. She invented the first hurricane party.
Yeah.
But continuing off of that, I was my... kind of, I guess, dumbing down of voodoo, kind of agreeing with what they said in the previous episodes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, just making sure. Yeah, hoodoo, I think, is the one that you don't want to mess with. That's the black art one. I don't want to be offending anybody, but I think that's what I heard. If not, I'm sorry. But anyway, continuing on with that, the papers tend to sensationalize, and not only that, you know, the game of telephone, it's what our show is about. Just, you know, one person says something, the next person says something, and then it ends up that just this woman, this tiny little 19-year-old girl, happened to have taken out entire families at once, you know? So there is that. But the fact remains that there still was this whole crime scene of not only this almost religiously posed family of murdered people, but also the writing on the wall, the actual, you know, human five signature on the door, and then the fact that all the children's hands were splayed like that. Somebody did that. And somebody was doing it intentionally, not just as a gag. I mean, maybe, but that seems a little bit too intricate to be, just to mislead somebody. Because if you murder somebody in a house, if I was to do it, which, you know, I guess I don't have the mind of the murderer because I have not, you know, done it. But I would want to get out there as fast as possible so I wouldn't get caught. It takes a lot of effort to actually set up the room as you see fit after you've done the killings, you know? And it every second increases your chances of getting caught, especially if somebody hears something in another room or in their house or just, you know, maybe somebody screamed before they got murdered. Just, I feel like that would be a situation where this really meant something to the person that did this. And it's just, I don't know, I really don't know what to land on for this case. But if it happens to be some sort of strange ritualistic cult mass, then that's one of the very first to ever actually be confirmed, you know?
Absolutely. And, you know, it's funny you mentioned, like, the fact of anybody making a noise, it amazes me how many of these families were big families, 4, 5, 6 people, and somehow or another, during the act of killing one, it didn't wake up the rest of the family. And in most of these cases, that was what it was said.
That's the most amazing part to me, is because I feel like there's at least some sound associated with an axe hitting a skull, blunt end or not. And that would wake up somebody, or at least a moan of like pain or something like that. And not to mention, like I said, one of them was shot in the head. And I guess that was the smart thing, because they thought the husband would be the stronger one that would be more likely to defend himself. So maybe they popped him off first and then just took care of the rest of the family, as gruesome as that is. But it's just amazing that entire swaths of families, it seems like there wasn't much resistance to any of these either. From what I've read, there wasn't anything like, what's it called, defensive wounds, like when somebody's actually trying to block themselves from being hit with an object or a weapon. There was none of that. So these people might have been, like, cold asleep. Now, that brings to the fact that maybe there was a coordinated group of people, in fact, and they all swung together.
And that makes more sense.
But they also left only one axe. So that also, unless maybe the axe was just kind of like a calling card, and they didn't need to leave every, you know, murder implement. So, that's just something I wanted to cover, because we get all the Delphine Lalaurie's down here. Everybody knows about that. Everybody knows about Myrtle's Plantation. Everybody knows about, the voodoo. And some people know about the Rougarou, which is just a fun little Sasquatch story. But in terms of Clementine Barnabé and her, you know, wonderful human five, I have not seen this done anywhere else. And apologies if somebody else has done it. I want to listen to your podcast talking about it, because it's probably going to be a better attempt at it than me.
Ryan, it was fun having you on. We greatly appreciate you coming on and sharing a little bit of your local lore knowledge. And
thank you for having me on. You guys are great. I'm glad to have you guys on Dark Myths. We're all glad to have you on Dark Myths. It's been awesome seeing the place grow, especially with people such as yourselves blowing up too. It's fun seeing everybody really coordinate and collaborating and cooperating.
That's a lot of C's.
Yeah, I like alliteration, you know.
But thank you so much. Tell everybody how they can find your show.
You can find us at rumorfliespodcast.com. Obviously, you can reach us at, you can find us on any podcast platform, iTunes, Stitcher, Podcast Addict, all of them. We're there. Greg made a point to get us on all of them. And then also, if you want to contact us, rumorflies@gmail.com. We have a Patreon if you want to check out some of our bonus stuff too, which, you know, if you like our show, check that out later on. Don't worry about that right now. But also, we have an Instagram, which is also Rumor Flies, and we have a Twitter, which we are pretty frequently on, which is also just @RumorFlies. So it's pretty much, if you just type Rumor Flies in Google, almost every result will be us.
Awesome. Well, guys, I appreciate it, and I hope you have a lot of luck in the future. Like I said, you guys have a really good show, and there's no doubt that it's just going to continue to grow and take exponential growth in the near future. I can just see it happening.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And I wish all the best to your podcast, too. And tell everybody else who said hey.
Well, thank you so much. I will. And we'll see you soon.
All right. Take it easy.
Listening to the Hillbilly Horror Stories Patreon bonus episode. Please welcome your hosts, Jerry and Tracy Pauly.
All right, welcome to the August edition of our Patreon bonus episode. We've got two long stories for you tonight.
Longa bonga.
Okay, actually, lad, we got one really long story and one regular story.
Liar.
But we're not going to waste a lot of time on chit-chat. You guys get to hear enough chit-chat during the regular show. We do have some awesome stories, so I figured we'd just jump right into it. Are you okay with that?
I'm good. Let's go.
But before we do, I do want to say thank you to all of you guys, because we're starting to get more and more Patreon supporters, and
I think this show will prove to you guys that we're actually trying to give you the best of the best. I would be willing to bet that this Son of Sam story that we're going to do tonight will be as good, if not better, than any story we've done ever on the regular show.
Well, that's a lot of pressure.
It is, but I've told you guys before on the regular show, I judge a story by how many notes, pages of notes it takes. And this particular story on Son of Sam, I have 17 pages of notes.
Oh, dang.
And that's right there with the Gary Demonhouse episode and the Lizzie Borden episode. I think one of them was 18, the other one was 17. So
that's whack. Get it? Whack. Get it?
But I think you guys are going to really be fascinated with that. So much so that I'm going to save that one for the second story. And we're going to do the Beast of Bray Road first.
Oh, all right.
Usually we do the paranormal stories last.
Oh, I gotcha.
But yeah, we're not going to this week.
Okay.
So let's jump right into it. The Beast of Bray Road.
I'll never be your Beast of Bray Road. Hey, I just made that up.
See, as soon as you got to sing that happy birthday thing.
Oh, well, I thought that was cool.
Now all of a sudden you're trying to sing everywhere.
Well, at least I said it right. I always thought it said, I'll never be your pizza burning. Now, how stupid is that?
And how did you think that you said it right when you said you're the Beast of Bray Road?
Because
that's not how the song goes. I've never heard Mick Jagger utter those words.
Well, you don't know. Maybe it's a new hit. I'll get with his manager.
They could use a new hit. I'm sure out of your singing, they will get no satisfaction.
Oh, slamma.
Okay, let's jump into the story before we run everybody off and get them to just pull their Patreon pledges. All right. The funny thing about the Beast of Bray Road is most of these sightings are in the Wisconsin area.
Oh.
And the thing about that is all these are primarily werewolf-type sightings.
Oh, well, maybe they like cheese.
Maybe so. Or cheap beer.
Oh.
Old Milwaukee.
Oh.
Obviously, I don't know. This is just taking a turn for the ugly right off the bat.
So I'm sorry.
Let's start over.
Oh.
So it seems that Wisconsin is the mecca of werewolf sightings in the U.S.
I had no idea.
Okay. I surprised you didn't say ideal.
I didn't. I was really good, wasn't I?
I know. Anyway, the most famous of which is the Beast of Bray Road, and that's what we're going to focus on today. These sightings are primarily took place in the 1980s and the 90s, and right in the Elkhorn, Wisconsin area. But locals will tell you there was plenty of sightings before then. So what does this Beast of Bray Road look like? It's going to depend on the person. The descriptions kind of varied a little bit. Mostly brown or gray fur, canine in the face, and sometimes on all four, sometimes it was standing on two legs. People would say that it was about 2 to 3 foot when it was on all four. Mm-hmm. That sounds funny. 2 to 3 feet when it's on 4 feet.
That does sound funny.
But when it stood up, it was around 7 feet.
Oh, dang.
Now, people would say it would range between 400 and 700 pounds, and the size was different depending on the sighting. So it's kind of all over the map,
but at the same time,
everybody's kind of, you kind of generalize it down. So let's talk about when this thing started. 1936, Mike Shackelman was driving on Highway 18 in Jefferson, Wisconsin. He saw a half man, half dog digging at the ground at like an Indian burial ground.
Wow.
Now, keep in mind, this was 1936. There's not a whole lot of talk of stuff like that going on in 1936. He said that the creature was about 6 foot tall, had the muzzle of a dog mixed with an ape.
What the hell?
He said it had long arms with 3 fingers. and the stench was like decaying flesh.
Well, they were close enough to smell
it? Yes, yes. He left.
He must have been drunk.
He left. He came back the next day, and he said the creature was still there, but this time it looked at him, and it said one word and left.
Shut up.
Goonie goo goo.
Quit making that up.
What he said the name was. He said that it said, Ghidorah. Ghidorah, mate. God, we are being entirely too silly for this.
I don't know, but that's just weird. How can he have all those different features on one thing?
Well, I mean, he was saying that it had a kind of a dog face, like a dog and an ape face mixed. I don't know.
The gape?
We are going to run everybody off. Anyway, so let's get back to he said, we are punch drunk. We have done nothing but work for 4 straight weeks, and now this is like the 7th show we've put out. One of them was 2.5 hours long. We've done a ton of interviews. We are giddy.
I'm sorry, y'all. I don't mean to be goofy. It just doesn't sound right to have an animal.
And now we're at the deadline where this needs to come out. We're actually recording this at 7:45, and it's got to be out tonight. So it's taken us this long to get everything together.
But 9 o'clock's my bedtime.
But
so
I promise it's going to get better.
I promise you. Sorry.
So he said Gadara. Gadara, when you look it up, it's a place in Israel. It's also, it was mentioned in the Bible several times, mostly with demonic type stories. So I don't know why this creature would look at him and say Gadara, but apparently it did.
That's so weird.
And then it just disappeared. 1964.
He didn't say bye?
No. 1964, Harvard, Illinois. Dennis Fiolis was driving, and he said this thing just jumped in front of him. And he ran through a cornfield. So the creature jumped in front of the car and then ran through a cornfield. Obviously, there was no proof of this other than just some broken corn stalks, which don't really prove anything.
Yeah.
1972, there was a woman in Wisconsin that called the Department of Natural Resources to report that a large, hairy creature tried to break into her house. She called back to say that it returned to harm one of her animals, leaving a deep cut from shoulder to shoulder.
Ooh.
And I don't know what kind of animal it is.
Aww.
So, now, here's the difference on this one. They actually found a footprint that was right around 12 inches long on site.
Daggone.
So, literally, the footprint was a footprint. September 1989. Scott Bray, on a dairy farm, saw a large dog, larger than a German Shepherd. Said it had pointy ears, black and gray fur. He said he followed it all the way to a rock pile, and then he kind of lost him. But once again, there were large footprints left. Mm-hmm. That same night, Russell Guest saw the same creature coming from behind some bushes on 2 legs. Said it was wobbling back and forth like he was uncomfortable to be on 2 legs. Had a wolf head, very wide shoulders, and he assumed it was a wolf-dog hybrid. And
so this was the same night. Is it footprints or paw prints?
I don't know.
Oh.
It depends because a werewolf is part human.
Well, so. Okay. Sorry. Go ahead.
1989, in the fall, Lori Indizi, she saw something on the side of the road eating something with its paws up. So it's kind of like it was holding, I don't know if it's doing the hokey pokey or...
You mean it wasn't like he was eating something that was dead and he was on his back and his paws were up, right?
No, I mean he was sitting up and he had something laying across his paws.
Oh, and he was eating his own paws.
Yeah, like we would eat something.
No.
For the most part. So he described it as being, she described it as being very muscular, gray and brown fur, a long snout, pointy ears. And the body was more like a human type body than an animal, and she said it had yellow eyes that even looked yellow even when the light wasn't on. So when there was no light shining on it, you could still see the eyes were yellow.
Oh wow!
Now in 1990, Mike Etten was driving on Bray Road. He saw something very similar to what Lori and Drizzy saw. But first he thought it was just a bear. But after hearing all the other reports, he said he had to rethink that. It probably wasn't a bear. He probably saw the same thing. But it was eating, sitting, on the side of the road with his paws up, eating something. Okay. The most famous case, obviously, as a lot of people have heard of, is 1999 on Halloween, of all things. 18-year-old Doristine Gibson. She said she was driving along Bray Road, and her car kind of jumped in the air as if she ran over something. She got out immediately because she wanted to see if she ran over something. She saw this hairy creature coming right towards her. Terrified, obviously, she jumps in the car. She took off, but then the beast jumped onto the trunk of her car. It had been raining, so luckily it just slid right off.
Oh, good
but
for
it,
her.
But it did kind of scratch the back of the car up.
Mm-hmm.
And she said she came back later that night with a friend of hers after some trick-or-treating, and an animal was still on the side of the road. She ordered the person she was with to lock the door, and she told her neighbor the next day that, you know, what she saw, and he looked at the scratches and stuff on the car. That's kind of, you know, the most famous story of this thing. So it's the only time where anybody actually claimed that it tried to attack. And there's, you know, been a bunch of other sightings of similar thing. And then even if you kind of cross a little bit over into Michigan, there's another cryptid over there that they call the Michigan Dogman, which is very similar.
Mm-hmm.
Almost the exact same description. People seeing the same thing. So that little area, that region up there of Wisconsin and Michigan, people are kind of thinking it could be the same creature, basically.
But he didn't seem like he was harmful to anybody except that one time.
Yeah, well, everybody seems to think that it's got like the body of a bear,
mm-hmm.
but like the head of a wolf, if that makes any sense. Hmm. That's kind of the most common description. So what is it? I mean, is it a werewolf? Is it a bear dog?
It's a misfit.
Is it a Wendigo? A Bigfoot? I mean, some people do think that it's Bigfoot.
Oh, my gosh.
And they're just seeing it as something else, but they think that that could just be a Bigfoot. The Native Americans in that area, they would consider that to be a Wendigo.
A Wendigo?
Yep. It's like when you got to go to the bathroom, you got to know when to go.
Good one.
So anyway, that's our quick little paranormal story tonight. So now we can focus on what I think is one of the better stories that we've done on this show.
Son of Sam.
This is a jacked up story. So.
And he's jacked up looking.
Yeah, he is a little unique. So let's jump right into this. I'm kind of excited about this one, so I'll be honest with you. I almost pulled this one to use on the regular show, but I thought, you know what? These guys are giving us their hard-earned cash. They deserve the best of the best. So you guys are always going to get our best stories. So
except for that one we just did, and we laughed too much, and we're sorry.
We are sorry, and now we will be less, hopefully,
laughable.
Sorry.
Or whatever.
Okay. Let's jump into this. All this really starts at early childhood, but the crime spree of it started December 24th, 1975, Christmas Eve. It was a 13-month killing spree by Son of Sam, which most people know by now is the gentleman known as David Berkowitz. He terrorized the streets of New York City looking for victims. Basically terrorized 16 million people all by himself.
Wow. Why you gotta do that on Christmas Eve? I know he didn't do it all on Christmas Eve. That's a happy time.
And it's kind of an odd, I don't know what the reasoning was for that, but let's go back to the very beginning. Who was David Berkowitz? Well, he was put up for adoption in the summer of 1953. Pearl and Nathan Berkowitz actually adopted him. He was only 3 days old.
Oh, that was nice.
They lived in the Bronx, and they couldn't have children of their own. One of David's earliest memories was being told that he was adopted. He was told that his mother died of childbirth. That was kind of a common thing,
mm-hmm.
you know, back then. As I guess people just told their kids they were adopted when they were young instead of trying to hide it. I don't know. But every time they would pass by the courthouse, his parents would point to it and say, "That's where the courts awarded you to us because we love you more than anyone in the world,"
mm-hmm.
which is sweet.
Mm-hmm.
Nathan worked 6 days a week at running a hardware store, so he was always at work. I know that feeling. Pearl was a stay-at-home mom, and she loved to show off David. So she would always take any opportunity to brag on him, take him to places, and, you know, like she was a proud parent. It was the basics of it. Nathan would take him to Yankee Stadium on occasion, and they would spend time with it. So it sounds like he really had a pretty decent childhood from that level. He was loved. David said he was given all the love in the world that he could ever want, but he was self-destructive and pushed it away. He would often get into fights at school because the kids would say that he wasn't a real kid because he was adopted. I mean...
Okay, that is just the dumbest thing ever.
I don't know how all the kids find out he's adopted unless he just told
them. Yeah, and he is a real kid, you big dummies.
He felt ashamed and guilty that his mom died while she was giving birth
to him. Did she really die? Or is that what they just said?
Can we get to it?
Oh, damn. We can get to it.
Well, thank you. He lived in fear that his dad was going to come and kill him for killing his biological mother. His imagination was fueled by horror movies that he watched all the time. So you got a warped mind. You already feel guilty about something, and you're watching all these horror movies. Yeah. What good is going to come out of that? He was so tormented by these nightmares that he would spend hours in the closet hiding, covered up with clothes, hoping nobody would find him.
Oh, my. What a terrible life.
He hated school. He would run home to his mom every day because he adored her, and that was the only person he felt comfortable with. So much so that he poisoned their parakeet because he saw it as a basically a rival for her affection.
Oh, jeez.
There's the first sign of a serial killer starting to kill animals. That's always the case. Or affecting animals or hurting animals. Anyways, she never suspected anything because that was her sweet angel.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this kid hung the moon. And I never use that phrase, but I thought it'd be fitting.
Yeah.
Even though he loved his mom, he was also very aggressive towards her sometimes. He would kind of yell at her and throw things at her, which is odd for somebody that he adored, but that was just the case. When he was 10, she took him to a child psychologist, so she already knew something was up and didn't help because David was a secretive kid, so he didn't want to bother saying anything.
He didn't want to talk about it.
Right. When he was 11 to 12, he would sneak out of his window at nighttime. Keep in mind, New York City. He would sneak out of his window and run the streets.
Wow, that's insane.
When he turned 13, he had his bar mitzvah. And in a Jewish religion, obviously, that's only kind of added to his guilt and shame. He said at one point, he said, "I'm not a proud Jew. Jews are supposed to be honest, law-abiding, and respectful of parents. I am none of these things. I am a disgrace."
Well, that poor kid.
So that's the way he felt.
That's so terrible.
Now, granted, he wasn't a kid when he made those.
Well, I know, but still.
Those comments.
I mean, you have all that love and all that stuff, and you still feel like you're worthless. That's just terrible.
Right. So one night, shortly after his bar mitzvah, during a temper tantrum, he said something that he would have to live with the rest of his life. One of the most horrible things, and this is why if there's any children out there listening, which I don't think any children are patrons, but I'm going to say it anyway, you got to be careful what you say because you never know when you're going to get an opportunity to correct some of these bad things. In this little fit of rage, he said to his mom, she was getting ready to go out to dinner, and he said, "I hate you, I hate you, I hope you die."
Uh-oh.
Unfortunately, nobody knew that she was actually in the advanced stages of breast cancer.
She wasn't.
She collapsed at dinner that night.
Oh, my gosh.
She didn't die, but they sent her to a cancer ward to where she pretty much just wasted away and died without ever really being conscious again to be able to talk to.
Oh, bless her heart.
The one person that he was the absolute closest to was now gone. He cried for days, and he had lost everything when she died, as far as he was concerned. She was it. He was very lonely, very shy. He's one of these type of kids that would blush really easily. Now he's a teenager. I mean, he's just getting into, 13, 14 years old. He was extremely shy around girls. Sometimes he would drive his bike for hours around town. Mostly, he'd go to the cemetery to visit his mom's grave. And he would just stay there for hours, fascinated by the headstones. He would always look at the ones and say, the ones that died young, and always be fascinated. He would even wonder to himself about the girls, if they were pretty or not pretty.
Oh, gosh. Which,
signs right there, things starting to turn.
Yeah, that's kind of sick.
His dad would plead to him and to say, "Look, hey, come talk to me," but David wouldn't have talked to her. So he just, he said kept it all bottled up. And in 1971, he graduated high school, barely, because he missed so much school that, truancy almost kept him from graduating. He then immediately enlisted into the Army. The funny thing was, when he went to the Army, he used to fantasize about being a hero.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of his things. He wanted to go to Vietnam and actually die in Vietnam a hero. That was his goal. Instead, he was sent to Korea, where he qualified as a sharpshooter with an M16. He tried to find a girlfriend over there, but right around the Korean camps and stuff where he was, there were all kinds around the base, all kinds of hookers and stuff like that. So he tried to actually find a girlfriend through those means.
No.
And in the end, though, he said he found it degrading. So.
Yeah.
He wrote a letter to his father apologizing pretty much for being a huge disgrace and amounting to nothing in life. He said that he didn't amount to anything in society, and he's sorry that he turned out the way that he did. Stupid, hateful, ugly, and destructive.
My God.
He begged his father to forget that he even existed.
Oh, my gosh. Boy, he needed a major hug.
Yeah. 1973, the Army transferred him to Fort Knox, Kentucky.
Nuh-uh.
Yep. He started attending a Baptist church there and soon became baptized. He felt like he had found a family that he actually belonged there. He liked the idea that he would see these families going to church. Mm-hmm. And that was like Sunday was church day and the whole family got together. And then the whole family went to eat dinner. And that he really liked that concept of it. Then all the preaching, though, that he would go through kind of reminded him that he was going to go to hell, in his opinion. And it was just a constant reminder of what the end result was going to be and how negative it was going to be and how bad it was going to be in hell. So he decided that the religion thing didn't really need to last long, and he kind of went away from the church. 1974, he was discharged from the Army after several before him and decided to return back to New York. He started classes at the Bronx Community College.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Nathan, his dad, since all this had taken place with the him being in the military and everything, he remarried a woman.
Mm-hmm.
So he's remarried to what was now his David's stepmom, and he moves to Florida. David resented his new stepmom and her daughter for basically invading his home and taking his dad away.
Hmm.
That's the way he looked at it. David, now 21, felt like that he had not like a curse on him, but he just had like a some kind of force around him that basically repelled people from him. And he calls himself a dismuch, which is Yiddish for dirty one. Definitely didn't have a very high self-esteem.
No, sure. Not at all.
So he goes out, he gets his own apartment, gets a job as a night watchman. He started thinking more and more about his real mom at this point. He started aggressively trying to find out anything he could about her. He went to a Freedom of Adoption meeting and told his story, basically. You know, it's kind of like a Freedom of Adoption meeting was for kids that had been adopted, people who had been adopted, kind of like an AA meeting or mm-hmm. something. Like, it's a support group. And he goes to this thing, and he starts telling people his story, saying, oh, my mom died, you know, when I was born. And people start laughing. And he's like,
oh, Lord.
I mean, what the hell's wrong with all you people? I'm telling you this sad story. My mom died during childbirth. And they're like, the people there are like, that's what they tell all of us.
He had no clue.
And he's like, what do you mean? He said, all of us are told that our mom died during birth. So he calls his dad, Nathan, up in Florida. And he just basically demands the truth. And Nathan told him that she was alive. And the adoption agency suggested that they were told that. He said that was just... That's what basically all the adoption agencies back then would tell anybody adopting a baby, tell them that their real mother died so they would not ever, you know, wonder about their parents, or it supposedly would have been the easy way out.
Well, yeah, but that's cruel.
So David was stunned, to say the least. I mean, all of this guilt that he'd suffered his whole life, he's 21.
Yeah.
He spent his entire life guilty because he thought his mom died during childbirth, blaming himself. And now all of a sudden he finds out she's not dead.
See, that's a shitty way to do those kids.
He goes and he finds out, doing some research, he finds his original birth certificate through the adoption agency. His name was Richard David Falco. His parents were Betty and Tony Falco. He searched for basically almost a year. He didn't find them. No luck. I mean, it's a lot harder back in the 70s.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. It would be. Yeah.
Today with Google and
I mean,
all
Falco,
that
too, is kind of an unusual name, so.
Yeah, probably not so unusual in New York.
Oh.
It's kind of a, you know, I would assume that's probably an Italian name.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of Italians in New York.
Yeah.
Not stereotyping, but I'm just saying there's a lot of Italians in New York.
I understand.
Frustrated, David, obviously he tried this whole religion thing during his Army days, now decided to try something a little different. He joined a satanic cult.
Well, that's way the other way.
He liked the fact that they had late night meetings in the woods and all the chants. He liked all the drugs and the opportunity to meet girls. Because, you know, that's where I find the best opportunity to meet girls is satanic cults.
Yeah, hey.
So, anyways, he basically connected easily to the dark forces that he worshipped in the satanic cult a lot more easily than he did the lighter forces when he was in the mm-hmm. Baptist or the Jewish religion. He even made a blood pact to serve the devil.
See, that just really pisses me off because, no, seriously, if they had just not told them kids this, his life would have totally probably been totally different and he wouldn't be famous for what he did.
Oh, you're probably right.
I mean, that's just awful.
I mean, when you think about it, and this guy, he was trying, all he really wanted, I can't say all he really wanted was to be loved because he had love, and at the same time, he still had issues.
Well, yeah. I don't know. I just don't understand that whole
thing. But you think about this. He's 20, 21, 22 years old. He's already been a Jew, a Baptist, and a Satan worshiper.
Yeah.
This is somebody, he's searching for something.
Well, yeah.
All right, so after basically a year now, he actually found his birth parents. His thoughts in his head were, oh my God, this is going to be the perfect family. It's mm-hmm. my mom, my real mom, my real dad. And I wonder if they got brothers, sisters. And
yeah.
He can't wait. He's all excited about it. That didn't really last long.
Aww.
Because when he met Betty basically, I guess, was kind of average. He expected this, like, June Cleaver-type mom, I guess. And it was this little meek lady
mm-hmm.
that, and she had this annoying voice, according to him. And she's like this Jewish voice or whatever, but this, she had this voice where she kept saying something like, I'm sorry, Richie. I'm sorry. And he said, just the sound of it just mm-hmm. made him want to put his hand over his ears. Mm-hmm. And he said it took everything he had to just not strangle her on the spot.
Oh my God.
And so he's like, well, you know what? He said, I'm just going to tell her I forgive her mm-hmm. and I love her and I'm going to move on.
What about Dad?
And that's what he did. That's a good point. Because let's talk about Dad. So he finds out through talking with her, he's like, you know, I'm sure she had a good reason for giving me up.
Mm-hmm.
No.
Oh.
Turns out Tony wasn't his real dad. It was a guy named Joseph Kleinman. Joseph Kleinman was a very well-off Jewish industrialist back then. He was pretty much a well-to-do businessman.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a reputation. We're talking about the 50s. And she was pregnant with his baby while she was having an affair. So the truth of the matter is, he was given up because he was an inconvenience.
Mm.
It was a shame because this wealthy businessman's like, I'm not going to have my name drug through the mud with having an illegitimate kid. And then the mom, she don't really want to have this kid around that's really not her husband's. So they gave him up for adoption. So you can imagine then this kid that's been searching for love his entire life. He finally meets his parents and thinks
they're both losers.
And he finds out that he basically, his way of putting it was, I didn't ask to be born to begin with.
Yeah.
And now I find out that I didn't even have to be born. I was an inconvenience because people playing around,
mm-hmm.
basically, and mm-hmm. not being careful. And now I've lived this life that I don't want to live because of that.
Man.
He did, though, find out that he had a half-sister, and she had two daughters, and he loved them.
Mm-hmm.
He was going over to their house. It was almost like his little half-sister was going overboard to try to make up for the mistakes mom made.
Well, good. I'm glad something good came out
He had the two little kids over there, and they would run and jump in his arms when he came over for dinner and call him Uncle Richie, and he liked that. But he said as time went on, I guess the hatred for what happened to his real mom and dad and then all that, what really went on, it started to get to the point where he felt like he wanted to kill his entire family. But he liked his half-sister. He loved those little kids. And he just felt that it was better that he just disappear, quit coming around.
Yeah.
And it was kind of odd that he told his half-sister, of course, it all made sense later. He said that he would never hurt her or her daughters.
Which is just an odd thing to say to somebody before you just disappear. But that's what he did. Now we're up to Christmas Eve, 1975. For some reason, he tried to stab a 14-year-old girl through her thick winter coat. Well, the knife wouldn't go through the coat, and what he ended up doing was just basically struggling with her. She got away, and during that whole process, he cut himself.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, I'm not going to do this anymore. So he decided that the next time that he was going to do something like this, it was going to be a little more impersonal, and he was going to use a gun. Basically, he just said for somebody who was withdrawn as he was, he didn't need to be that close to people.
Mm.
So he was just going to do it.
He's going to shoot from afar?
Yep. He decided he was just going to get a gun. So in the spring of 1976, he couldn't sleep at his place because he said the dogs that were barking next door, just barking nonstop, it just got on his nerves. That's going to come into play a little later too, as you're going to see a theme. He moved to an apartment building by the Hudson River, only to find, guess what? More dogs.
Oh, man. Don't he check that crap out before he moves in?
Who checks out who's got dogs that bark?
Well,
are you going to camp out for a couple of nights and scope the situation?
I mean, are you talking about dogs in the park or dogs in the apartment?
No, these are dogs, I guess, next to, I don't know. Oh. They were dogs next door. Well, no, the dogs were next door to him.
Okay.
1976 to 1977, he drove a taxi. He worked at the post office. He did a little bit of everything. Mm-hmm. He'd sometimes drive to the beach and just sleep in his car just to get some peace.
Yeah.
He would take long walks on the beach the whole time just to try to clear his head, think about stuff. I mean, as he got older, this thing started churning within him, and that's obviously where we're getting ready to start getting to the bad stuff. Now at 23 years old, he decided that he needs to slay a woman. He needs to kill a woman just to kind of get revenge for how he's been treated.
That makes no sense.
But, I mean, that's in his thoughts. That's what would fix stuff. So he went to Florida to see his dad. His dad caught him staring into a mirror and pounding himself in the head.
Oh.
He tried to get David to go get help. But David wouldn't go get help. Not only would he not go get help, he told his dad it was too late. He drove to Houston to visit a friend that he had from the Army. And he talked his friend into buying him a .45 bulldog. And he said that he needed it for protection on the way back to New York. So his friend, you know, went ahead and did that. Now these barking dogs become unbearable. You got this sexual frustration building up in him. July 29, 1976, Jody Valente was dropping off her friend, Donna Loria, in the Bronx. David saw them. They were laughing. They were parked. Just having a good time in front of their apartment building. Mm-hmm. He circles around a little bit, sees them. Then he decides he's going to drive about two blocks down. He parks his car. He walks back, circles around the car. Well, Jody turns around and sees him. And she says, "Who's there?" He pulls the gun out of a brown paper bag and just started shooting. And then he just kind of stood there frozen, like he can't believe what he did.
Mm-hmm.
Jody kind of leaned forward and just started hitting the horn.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Donna's dad was in the apartment building upstairs. He sees what's going on. He rushes out. David, by the time her dad gets there, he's already took off running.
Yeah.
Dad comes down there. He grabs Donna up into his arms, but by that time, it was too late. She was dead.
Aw.
Jody was shot in the thigh, but she was able to give a full description of him.
Yeah.
As he stood there staring at her, so she got a really good look. He fled in a 1970 yellow Ford Galaxy. Now, he said that he felt a certain level of peace. Ninja, we're talking about a guy who don't like barking dogs, and now you're going to jump in here. Do you want Son of Sam to come visit you?
I'll protect you, Ninja.
You will not. All right, dang. So anyway, he said that he felt a level of peace after shooting them. Mm-hmm. And then he said that it was like a sexual, or it was like having an orgasm, yeah. But it wasn't a sexual orgasm. It was more like a mental one. Mm-hmm. He said it was after the shooting, he felt like he was walking on air.
Oh, wow.
Now, keep in mind, at this point, he didn't know if he'd killed anybody or not. He just knew that he'd shot into the car.
Yeah.
He didn't know until the next day when he was reading the New York Post and saw that
somebody
was actually killed. After that, he started cruising the streets almost every single night looking for victims. He would cruise through neighborhoods that bordered the highway. So that was kind of his MO. And then you're going to find that most of his victims mm-hmm. were all within like a 2-3-4 block radius of where this was. Almost oh, wow. everything was right there.
Oh.
The fall of 76, he wounded two girls and a guy that he probably mistook for a woman. One was paralyzed. One was shot in the neck, and the male had to have a mental plate put in his head.
Oh, gosh.
He knew at this point in time, this is according to his own words, that he was crossing a moral threshold where a human actually has the ability to play God. He could decide who lived and who died.
What a sicko.
Now, this is where you start realizing how really screwed up this guy is. He also, at the same time, fantasized about being a hero. He would drive around looking for victims, but at the same time, he was also looking for people to save.
What do you mean?
Just in general, if he's looking for people in distress. He always had emergency equipment in back of his car in case he ran across like a burning building or he literally had thoughts of saving somebody from a burning building and being a hero. At yeah. the same time, he's looking for somebody to kill.
That is really twisted and messed up.
In February of 1977, he, with his gun in his pocket, mind you, he helped teenagers push a car out of a snowbank.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the kind of stuff he was doing. Mm-hmm. Yet later on that night, he killed a secretary by the name of Christian Frowned.
Oh.
Now, keep in mind, police didn't have any idea that all these murders were connected.
So is he's just basically killing women, though.
Yes. And we'll get into a little more details about that. There was a ballistics expert that kept seeing the same bullet now. There was three different murders at this point, and he thought, well, this is kind of a unique gun. And now he's starting to see mm-hmm. this bullet in some cases.
Yeah.
And he's like, hey, we've got a wacko out there. Because at this point, nobody had put two and two together. 5 weeks later, on March 8th, the fifth attack happened. Virginia Vascher. I'm going to try this.
I would just say Virginia because that's a long butt name.
Virginia Vascher. Fresh to reach her, he came up upon her. She seen him. She held up her school books. She's come home from school. She held them up
to protect herself.
Yeah, she held them up to her face. He shot through the school books and shot her in the head and killed her.
No. Oh.
By now, everybody's starting to put two and two together with the police. Yeah. He was known as the .44 caliber killer. That's what the newspapers were starting to call him. That's what the police were calling him.
Mm-hmm.
At this point, he was mainly killing and going after wounding women with long brunette hair.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they were looking. So what started happening was he was terrorizing the town so much that women started cutting their hair short.
Oh, I was going to say.
They started wearing their hair up and they started dyeing it. If they had dark hair, they would dye it blonde or red or whatever because they thought he was only looking for.
Yeah. You know, I would have done the same thing.
Right. But so that's kind of was the thought process. Now in April of 1977, his neighbor, Sam Carr with the barking dogs, he wrote a letter to him, to Sam. And he's basically said, if you don't control your dogs, I'm going to take legal action. This is a guy that's out killing people, mm-hmm. wounding people, but he's going to write a letter to his next door neighbor saying he's going to file legal action. He showed in this letter that he wrote him
how much he really wanted a relationship. This is according to experts after the fact, reading this stuff. Because keep in mind, up to this point, as far as I know, he's never been with a woman.
I don't get why he wrote a letter. Okay, I'll let you finish. Yeah, I'm getting to that point. There's got to be something in there.
Right. Well, the letter that he wrote to Sam Carr, it talked about a wife that he had, which he really didn't have. He basically said, look, you know, my wife and I are wanting to spend some time alone. We've taken some time off work to be together, to be able to read, to make love, to just sleep in if we want to. And we're not getting any peace at all because of your barking dogs.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, why he didn't just write and say, hey, your dogs are barking, I can't get any sleep, or it's getting on my nerves.
Yeah, well, you had to put all
he
that in.
He put
there.
All this into. So that tells people, that tells the FBI profilers that he really would wanted to be in a relationship.
Yeah.
He's, at this point, he gets no response at all from Sam Carr, his neighbor. So now he's wrote this letter, nothing comes back. April 17th at 3 a.m., he's heading home, and he walks up to a patrol car, and he drops a note. Now, you got to keep in mind, the cops now are kind of on to some of what's going on. And this is going to sound extremely stupid. But after they figured out the bullets, they started talking about this guy has an M.O.
Uh-huh.
And his M.O. is very similar to Starsky and Hutch. Some episodes of Starsky and Hutch. They literally watched every episode of Starsky and Hutch hoping it would give them a lead.
Oh, my goodness.
So he drops this. Now that he knows that the cops are looking for him and it's starting to come out in the paper, he starts getting kind of cocky.
So you mean he dropped a note in the police car with the police in it?
I don't think the cop was there, but there was a patrol car. He literally had this sealed up letter that had a detective's name on it. On the outside of the letter, the envelope. He drops it by the patrol car. Then he walks straight up to a car and starts firing into the car. Valentina Siriana and Alexander Esau were both killed instantly. The note was the first solid lead that they actually had on him. I mean, everybody kind of was starting to put two and two together. They had you know, eyewitness accounts of what the guy looked like, but they didn't have anything to tie him.
Well, I guess he used gloves to drop the...
Oh, I don't know.
Yeah, because couldn't they have got fingerprints
off
of the envelope?
I'm sure they probably could have. We're still talking in the 70s. I don't know how good all their fingerprint technology was back in the 70s. So here's what some of the letter says. I am hurt by how you're calling me a woman hater. I'm not, but I am a monster. I am the son of Sam. I love to hunt, prowl the streets. I don't want to kill anymore, period. But I must honor thy father. Let me haunt you with these words. I'll be back. Kind of like Arnold Schwarzenegger. But Arnold didn't kill people like that. It was, well, he did, but...
That is so crazy.
This started the biggest manhunt ever in New York City. It's like I said, they did all the Starsky and Hutch stuff. A week later, he wrote Sam Carr another letter. He said, it's obvious I'm not going to have any peace in my life until I end your life.
Oh, gosh.
So,
well, that's pretty straightforward.
Then he shot and wounded his dog.
Aw.
Right.
Dogs bark. That's what they do.
The papers were starting to really come out and try to even put stuff in. The papers came out and they said, hey, son of Sam, you need to give up. This was actually headlines in the paper.
Oh, wow.
He responded with a very eerie poem, and I'll read you some of it. He says, hello from the gutters of New York City, which are filled with dog manure, vomit, stale wine, urine, and blood. I'm still here. I'm like a spirit roaming the night, thirsty, hungry, seldom stopping to rest. Anxious to please Sam, I love my work. Now the void has been fulfilled.
And none of that rhymed, by the way.
Well, you know, not all poems rhyme.
Not one damn thing rhymed. That's a turnoff.
June 26, 1977. He stalked out a disco in Queens. He shot and wounded two more girls. But see, this was a little different because he hadn't went to Queens in any of them.
Mm.
Everything I told you before, remember, it was in like a couple of like 2, 3, 4 blocks. Block radius.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Not only that, you know, it was a disco, so they probably deserved it.
No, they did not.
Okay, I'm just kidding. But it was disco. He should have just shot all the albums.
Well, he shouldn't shoot at all.
But if you're going to shoot something, disco albums would have been the thing to shoot.
Yeah, well, I love disco, so.
Whatever. July 31st. It's another name I have trouble pronouncing. Stacy Moskowitz and Robert Viel. Why does everybody in the city have to have a hard name?
Mm.
We're talking about New York City, and you think I was talking about Russia or something. Mm-hmm. So Stacy Moskowitz and Robert Violeta. Sorry, Robert, if you're still alive. They were making out in a car, like hot and heavy making mm-hmm. out. He shot both of them while they were making out.
That's just rude.
Stacy lived for 39 hours before she passed.
Aww.
Robert lost one eye and was partially blinded in another eye.
Oh my gosh.
Now, because of the fact that this thing, his, you know, he was starting to become famous for all this,
mm-hmm.
her murder was basically all over the world's news at this point. It made headline news everywhere.
Why?
Well, part of the fact was now the police were starting to have the letters and all this mm-hmm. stuff, and this is really the first one after the letters.
Yeah.
So now the fact that they had leads and stuff and they had the biggest manhunt going on, it just was something that everybody now was keeping up with.
Okay.
He finally feels important. I mean, because he's all over the place. He's the son of Sam, and he's mm-hmm. all over the papers. I mean, here's the thing, though, about Stacy. He also, we told you he went outside the area to Queens.
Yeah.
Which gives a whole different level of scaredness because people in Queens wouldn't worry about him because he wasn't going out there.
Right.
Stacy was short hair and blonde. He was the exact opposite of what he had been doing. So now he basically just he can scare everybody now because now it doesn't matter what you look like. It doesn't matter what part. Now he can be anywhere. Here's the funny thing. The night that he killed Stacy, he watched cops actually put a parking ticket on his car.
Damn.
He paid the parking ticket a week later. Cops tracked the car down to David Berkowitz. They discovered that he had been sending harassing letters to several people, including a man named Sam Carr that said he shot his dog.
See? That's what you get for paying your damn parking ticket.
Right.
Dumb.
So August 10th, 1977, they had a large team of agents sat outside of his apartment building. He came walking out with a paper bag. Got into the car. Then a cop came over to him, pointed a gun at him, told him to freeze, which he did. He looked up at the cop and said, "Well, you finally got me." And the cop says, "Who do I have?" He said, "The son of Sam." No fights.
I can't believe he gave up that easy.
Yep, no fights, no struggle, just flat up.
And the cop was like, yeah.
He confessed to everything. He revealed details that only the killer would have known.
Wow.
Not only that, he enjoyed talking about it.
Well, I can see that.
He smiled nonstop. If you look at any videos
mm-hmm.
of him being taken in by police, walking through the courtroom, there's video footage of him in the back of the police cruiser. He is grinning ear to ear. Kind of scary when you think about
mm-hmm.
it. Police said that he was very nice and polite. They asked him why he paid the parking ticket. And he said, because I'm a law-abiding citizen.
Oh, God. Apparently, he doesn't know what that means all the way. Oh, my gosh. Well, thank God he paid that parking ticket.
He came out and said that he was ordered to kill by demons, and his neighbor, Sam Carr, was the devil. Hmm? And Sam Carr was the one putting all this into his head, mainly, and sending his demons to...
Oh, wow.
And that's why he was hearing the barking dogs and all that. It was just a way of tormenting him, basically. He spent 8 months being evaluated to see if he was fit to stand trial.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the people where he was staying at, it was still like a jail, but it was more like a mental institution slash jail.
Yeah.
They said that for the first several months he was there, that he ate like a horse and slept very well. I mean, that doesn't sound like somebody that's got any concerns whatsoever.
Mm-mm.
He said that he didn't have anything against any of his victims, that they never did anything to him, but Sam wanted them all dead. Therefore, he's got to do what pleased his master, which was Sam. Now you move forward just a little bit longer, and those feelings kind of went away to where now he's feeling suicidal. They find out that he was fit to stand trial, and he decided against his attorney's wishes to plead guilty. He called his dad to tell his dad that he was going to plead guilty and to forgive him for that, which... I imagine his dad probably didn't want to have shit to do with him.
Well, I would say not.
And when his dad found out that he was the killer, there was a press conference with his dad, and his dad just said that he just sat and cried.
Hmm.
You know, because he said he knew he had issues, and just to know that his son that they brought up was responsible for killing 6 people and wounding 7 others in a year's time and causing so much other havoc and terror on a city. That it just was too much to handle. So I don't know why he would even call his dad to say, "Hey, I'm sorry for pleading guilty." Well, what you did it. I mean,
The
pleading guilty part ain't what you need to be apologizing for.
Yeah, and maybe just imagine how hard that is on his dad to have to live with that. And
his dad by this time was like in his late 60s, like 67, 68 years old. So
mm-hmm.
he was starting to be an older guy. And, so anyway, so in May 1978, he pleaded guilty. 2 weeks later. On the day of the sentencing, this is weird in its own self, he threw this tantrum, right?
Mm-hmm.
He broke the restraints that they had him on.
Oh, my gosh.
He went into the courtroom. They get, you know, finally corralled him, get him into the courtroom. He sees Stacy Moskowitz's mom, and he starts saying, "Stacy was a whore. Stacy was a whore." To the mom.
What the hell?
And then he screamed, "That's right, I killed him, and I'd kill them all again." Well, they pull him out of the courtroom. June 13th, which was about 2 weeks later, they bring him back in. And this time he's like a completely different person. He's completely calm and
mm-hmm.
all that. And the
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.